Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission, to explore strange new worlds. To boldly go where no one has gone before.
Engage.
Engage. Enterprise, Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Catherine Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
This is Captain Jonathan Archer.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage. Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And to make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Hailing frequencies open, sir.
Hey, hey. All right, we are back with another episode of Engage. The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage.
And I am Jordan Hoffman, your host. And I hope you listened last week because this is part two of a series of our away mission. I took the mobile emitter and went way up north to the frozen lands of Ticonderoga, New York, which is not too far. I'd say it's about 3.5-4 hours north of New York City, about 2 hours south of Montreal, Canada. And on a beautiful lake called Lake George. And if you listened last week, you know that the original series set tour is there. A great place to go in summertime. Our friend James Cawley, who led the tour, took us through. And it's great. It's like walking through a dream. I mean, you heard it. Brian, you heard it, right?
I'm about halfway through it as of now, as of this recording. So, but yes, it sounds like a lot of fun so far.
It's a lot of fun. It's, if you're a fan, it's a lot of fun. It's got, literally has all the whistles and bells. And what the reason we were there is a special day called Authors Day. And they had they invited a number of Star Trek authors, the book authors, like our friend David Mack, who's been on this show twice. And about, I think it was like 13 altogether. And they set up their little booths and they sold stuff and gave autographs and took pictures of one another. And it was a great time. And since I was there taking the tour myself, I said, I'm not going to pass up an opportunity to speak to some of these people, some of whom I've never met and have wanted to meet for a long time. So what did I do? I made it so.
Make it so.
I decided to interrupt these people in the middle of their commerce. There they were talking to their public, making a dime. And I said, let me tear you away. And we spoke to four. We didn't want to go overboard. So we spoke to Michael Jan Friedman. We spoke to David Gallanter, we spoke to Kevin Dillmore, and we spoke to Keith R.A. DeCandido. And we're going to hear those conversations now. In the order, I think what we're going to do it is, I think we'll do Michael first. Brian, take a note, because you're the one that has to edit this together.
Yes, sir.
We're going to do Michael first, and then Keith. It was very funny, but Keith's was the longest one. Then we'll do David, and I only spoke to him, David Gallanter. That was only like 5 minutes, because I don't know, he had to go somewhere. And then we'll wrap it all up with Kevin, who's like an old chum. Kevin is, Dayton Ward's, frequently works alongside Dayton Ward, and Dayton has been a guest on the show before, and Kevin's a wonderful man. And he, you want to close it out with him, because I'm being deadly serious, he's a sweet and gentle man. I really love Kevin, Dillmore. Kevin, if you're listening, I love you. Dayton, if you're listening, I love you too. Damn it, I love everybody. And you know what else I love, Brian?
I don't know. What is it?
I love having enough space on my hard drive.
Oh, so do I.
Well, the good people at Western Digital love this podcast, and they have decided to sponsor us, and thank God for that, because they know that our listeners are the type of people who need plenty of space when they're doing their computing, right?
Yes.
We are not casual people who zip around with one of those thin little air computers. No, we have a station where we really compute, with a capital K, we compute. And what we need is a serious hard drive for serious business. And if you are thinking about getting a new one, The one you want is Western Digital, WD. And I'm going to tell you that with WD, you are now able to get solid-state drives and hard drives to fit your unique needs. When you add the superior performance of a WD solid-state drive to your PC, you get blazing read speed so you can boot your system quickly or load games or other applications in a snap. Combined with the reliable WD hard drive, you get up to how many terabytes?
6 terabytes.
6 terabytes. Now, I mean, this is serious business. That's a lot. That's a lot of space.
It really is a lot of space. You can save in insane amounts of space.
That's like the entire beta quadrant is 6 terabytes.
Very possible.
A lot of space. You get 6 terabytes of storage to keep your games library, direct feed videos, podcasts, and more all in a single place. And this is kind of the important part. This has all been a prelude to this. And then I'll stop talking about it. But this is kind of a big deal. For a limited time, shut up. For a limited time, Engage listeners can get 20% off a WD solid state drive. 20% off is no joke. So if you're thinking about getting a new drive, do it. You're hearing my voice.
Now's the time.
Now's the time. Just hit pause on me. Open up another window. Go to W, or you can keep playing and listening. Go WD.com/engage, and there's a coupon code. WD.com/engage. Check out the drive that's good for you. You know, save yourself because you're at the max on the old one. You want a nice, fresh, clean, solid-state drive, and use WD Engage, all one word. It's like WD-engage. WD Engage. WD-engage. Is the coupon code WD Engage, and you go to WD.com/engage. All right, make it happen. And that's how you're going to get a great situation with your computer. So now we're going to go back in time. We're going to go back. We are upstate Ticonderoga, New York. Listen to last week's show if you missed it. But now we're going to talk to our fun friends who were up there a few weeks ago. Okay, so we're recording, and we're back here, and we've got in the hot seat now Michael Jan Friedman, who has written probably up there with Peter David and David Mack. Have you written the most Star Trek books of all, or is it still Peter David?
I think Peter may have written more than I have. I've written about 35 Star Trek
books. That's a lot. That's a lot. And not just Star Trek, also you've written DC Comics and...
Right. Another... About 75 books all together, and probably close to 200 comics.
Wow. Okay. So you just keep your laptop with you at all times, constantly creating content.
I'm really not in the 21st century, to tell you the truth. I came up here without a GPS. I don't have a laptop, but I do have this computer at home, and that works pretty well.
So, taking this tour today, I mean, you've never been up here before, right?
Never been here.
But you've been to conventions, and they sometimes try to recreate the set, or they abridge, or they have the captain's chair, or whatnot. But this is just a whole other scene, right?
It is. I think because it's not just one set. It's, you know, it's the bridge, it's engineering, it's sick bay, it's the corridors. You kind of immerse yourself in it in a way that you wouldn't if it was just one set on a dealer's room floor.
Yeah.
Is there a part of you that wishes you had seen these 20 years ago to kind of help you get into the mindset of what you're writing?
No.
Would it help you in any way, shape, or form? Or is it all imagination?
Probably not, because, you know... What you have here are props, essentially. You know, it's a location full of props, and it's a lot of fun, and it makes me feel good to do it. But I don't know that it would have enhanced my writing necessarily, because you're working from basically the same evidence that they are. You can see the episodes, and that was, you know, I think that was enough. Yeah. I don't see a particular advantage as a writer, but I have a feeling other writers would say otherwise, because the kind of pictures they were taking looked to me like they were going to be referenced.
Ah, so this is a big this is a research trip, not just a fun trip, is what you're suggesting.
That's right. Not so much for me, but I think for some of the others, I think definitely it was.
I want to talk a little bit about writing Trek novels, just sort of.
How did you? What was your process getting into the mindset of, you know, when you're writing? I know you have a table full of books here, and some of them are your created, your own original, you know, created characters and whatnot. But when you're jumping into Kirk, Spock, McCoy, or Next Gen, or something, characters that people already know, how do you get into the mindset to get in that groove of, you know, you got to put your stamp on McCoy or Kirk or Spock or somebody, but it's still got to be the guy everybody knows?
Well, I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. One thing, one big thing that people may overlook a little bit is the dialogue. There are certain things that certain characters do when they speak. And if you capture those things, people go, wow, you've captured the character. You know? Picard, when he addressed Riker, would always say, number one. If you could start a sentence with number one, it went a long way toward giving the impression that you've really captured the character. So there is just certain key words and phrases in the dialogue. In terms of you know, it's a little bit of a high wire act, capturing the character and also expanding the character. Can't expand them too much, but if you don't expand them at all, then it's kind of boring.
Right. If everything sets back to exactly the same spot, it's what's the point of this in a way?
So you have to say I'm gonna do something incremental. If I do something too big, they won't let me do it. If I do something too small, it's insignificant. So you're just going to make some incremental change in the character that won't be at odds with what they have planned in the TV series or in the movies.
I'm gonna ask you a question you're going to hate. But if somebody is like, you know, I've always wanted to read one of your books, but I haven't done it yet, what would be the first one that you recommend? Of one of your Star Trek books, obviously.
Which I would say...
And you can only pick one.
And I can only pick one. I would say Double Double. It was the first book that I wrote back in the 80s. And I think it's as good an introduction as any to my writing. You know, it's funny. It's a little discouraging because that was the first Star Trek book I did. I think also it was one of my best.
Yeah. Because it was Chasing the Dragon ever since.
Right? It was like 30 years of pent up
Star Trek love.
Star Trek love, yeah. And so that made it a good
and
book.
And this is a TOS book, right?
It's an original series book.
Yeah.
And it takes off where What Are Little Girls Made Of leaves off.
Oh.
Which Trek universe are you most comfortable in?
Ian just asked, which Trek universe are you most comfortable in?
Well, I think it would be a toss-up between original series and Next Gen. Maybe a little more Next Gen at this point. Obviously, the first book or two that I wrote was original series because Next Gen was only getting started. But I like those. I'm pretty comfortable in Deep Space Nine and Voyager as well. But I like original series and Next Gen better than the other incarnations.
Now, you also had a hand in writing the Voyager episode, Resistance. Mm-hmm. How did that come about? What was that experience like? And how happy were you with the finished episode?
Oh, my God.
For those who could not hear, Ian asked about the episode Resistance season. What a Voyager was that?
It came out in December of... I'm not sure if it was technically first season. I think it was December of the second year.
Okay, so early on in Voyager, the episode Resistance, you were the co-teleplay author of.
Right.
And Ian asks, how happy were you with the finished result? And even though listeners can't see, I'll try to describe the look on your face.
I'll tell you.
Yes, tell us, please.
You know, first of all, my writing partner for that, Kevin Ryan and I, had been pitching for years. And we had gotten lots of encouragement from the producers of each particular show. We had pitched to Next Gen, we had pitched to Deep Space Nine, and we'd gotten lots of encouragement, but as Kevin used to say, it was a lot of nibbles, no bites. You know, typically they would say, yes, it's in development, yeah, we're doing that. No, we were going to do that, we decided not to because of this. Very seldom did they say, no, we don't like that idea. So we were encouraged, and we kept pitching. Finally, we pitched one time to Jerry Taylor, and the pitch was Janeway plays Dulcinea to a Quezon Don Quixote. And she said, I really like that. Let's hold on to that one. We pitched our others, and she goes, the Don Quixote one, I really like that. We've never done that. And I think it would be great for Janeway. Let me just talk to the rest of the writing staff and see, you know, just to check. But I think we're going to buy that. So the next morning, we talk to her, and she goes, yep, we want it. But I have to tell you something. This morning, we got substantially the same pitch. And had you pitched in the afternoon instead of yesterday, we would have taken the other one.
Uh-huh.
That's how tenuous it is. You know, they would get 1,000 pitches from, you know, 200 different people.
Yeah.
And they only took 4 or 5, I think. So the odds of being able to do that were, you know, they were astronomical against. And I didn't find it hard to believe at all that somebody else had come up with the same idea. We were just lucky that we came up with it, what, 16 hours earlier. How happy was I? I was ecstatic. I was ecstatic because there's a huge difference between being somebody who writes Trek and somebody who is part of the Star Trek, who has contributed directly to the Star Trek mythos, the screen product. It's just a quantum leap, and I was on cloud nine. The experience, by the way, was wonderful. You know, you hear about all these people who have Hollywood horror stories. Oh, they took my baby, they mangled it, they spit it out. It was nothing like what I offered them. I felt abused and dirty. Nothing like that for us. I mean, we were very well respected. We were kept abreast of everything. We were invited to the shoot. Jerry Taylor couldn't have been more, you know, nicer or more professional. They shared everything, and it was a great, great experience. The only thing that surprised us was we had intended for the Don Quixote character to be a Brian Dennehy type. In fact, we were thinking they would probably get Brian Dennehy, and instead they got Joel Grey. And when we heard that, it was like, Joel Grey, what? But when we saw the episode, we were thrilled because it was by far the best performance I'd ever seen him give. It couldn't have been better.
Yeah, probably the type of role he doesn't normally get, so he was very excited to put a spin on it.
And apparently he's friends with Kate Mulgrew.
Ah. And I thought you were going to say Miguel de Cervantes. Yeah. He's very good friends with him.
No, he's not that old. Not that old.
Right.
They went to school together.
And Remo Williams.
And Remo Williams. Right. So I think they knew each other. They were friends. I think that was a factor in how well it went.
You've written also some, and Ian mentioned this a moment ago, some of the reference books. Did you do the Q book? Was that you?
Q's Guide to the Galaxy. Yeah, you know, we were...
Was that like written in collaboration with John DeLancey in some way? Or?
No.
Okay.
It was written in collaboration with Bob Greenberger, as a matter of fact.
Oh, really?
Bob contributed to it.
So tell me about, what's that like to do one of those kind of fun... non-canonical Q's guy. And there's a few, you know, there's Neelix's cookbook is a bestseller, has sold a tremendous amount of copies, and Q's Guide to the Galaxy, something that I have. It's a blast. You know, it's a fun little book.
I had the idea. I brought it to Margaret Clark, who was the editor I was working with at the time, and there were books that, like DC Comics, had come out with a series of books called Big Book Of. The big book of little crooks, the big book of conspiracies, and these artifacts in the book, I thought were fascinating, and I thought if we could do that for Star Trek, and then I was thinking, well, you know, we could make it funny, and we did, and it was a ton of fun to write. Bob and I have collaborated on other things, so it was. That went very well, but we know John DeLancey was actually not a part of that.
Gotcha.
Although I have collaborated with him on a comic book story.
Oh, really?
There was a Q story.
Well, he knew that you got Q's voice right in the Guide to the Galaxy.
So yeah, right, right.
What was the Q story you did with him?
It was a story, a Q and Picard story that that appeared in one of the DC Next Generation annuals.
Gotcha.
And he had written it and originally, and they thought it needed some work, and I think he was disinclined to do that, so they brought me in, and we didn't actually talk about it, but we did eventually, in effect, work together.
Let me ask you a fan culture question. You can be diplomatic if you must, because you span all things, DC Comics and Trek, and you come to events like this, and then you go to sort of, you know, more comic book-focused events. Is there something different in the DNA of someone who's just a Trek fan as opposed to somebody who's just a comic book fan?
Is there sometimes? Sometimes. I mean, sometimes they're one and the same, and sometimes they have tons in common. Comic book fans are often more enchanted by the artwork.
Ah.
Okay. Yeah. And that's, you know, somebody who's really into the artwork would not necessarily be a Star Trek fan. The Star Trek fans are about the continuity and the philosophy,
yeah,
and the literary aspects of it. Even when it comes to comics, I remember having a conversation with the Justice League editor, you know, quite some time ago, and he was saying, in the Star Trek comics, why don't you have more action? Why isn't there more, you know, superhero style action? Why is it so much? Why are there so many talking heads?
Yeah.
And I said, because these talking heads are saying interesting things. And that's what...
Let them talk.
That's right. What Star Trek readers, yeah, want to read.
That's interesting. I mean, you're speaking in generalities, but I think you're right. I mean, as a general rule, the comics in Star Trek are usually... are not quite as all in just the artwork and the, you know, the look. There's no Jack Kirby of Star Trek comics, but that's okay, you know, it's different strokes.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Michael, what's the most recent Trek thing you've written, and when will you be doing more, or will you be doing more?
The most recent Trek thing I've written, I think, was Death in Winter, which came out about 10, 12 years ago. But I was at a convention at the Star Trek convention in October, I think it was, in New York, and I spoke to the Ed Schlesinger, who's in charge of the Star Trek publishing program, and we did talk about my doing some new Trek work. Right now, they're renegotiating their license. But pretty soon, I hope to have something lined up with them again.
And real quick, what else are you working on now? Doesn't have to be Trek.
What else am I working on? Well, one thing, two things come to mind. One is I'm a founding member of Crazy 8 Press, where I and six other established writers work on our purest visions. The kinds of stories that traditional publishers can't necessarily touch because they need certain numbers, and we don't. And these are these kinds of stories that are nearest and dearest to us. The other thing I'm working on is a comic book called Empty Space. And it's kind of a cross between Star Trek and Lost. So it's weird stuff happening. And what you initially think is, oh, it's kind of a Star Trek environment, with a Brazilian artist, a great artist. His name is Caio Cacau. He does my book covers, and he's a very talented guy. And Empty Space, I'm hoping, will launch on Comixology in a couple of months.
Oh wow! Yeah. Awesome. Cool. Great. Well, listen, thank you so much for taking... I mean, you want to get back to your booth there, but thanks so much for taking the time. We're big fans of you here. And you're in New York, right?
Yes, I am.
You know, one of these days we'll have you come up to Deck 44, our studio, and we'll do a more thorough going over of everything. But for now, thanks so much.
Great. My pleasure.
Awesome.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
Okay, so we're back. We're back on Engage. We've got one of the greats with us here today, the Bronx's favorite son, Keith R.A. DeCandido. I pronounced that all
DeCandido.
Correct? DeCandido. It's on this, the accent.
Everybody gets it wrong. It's fine.
And K-Rad, as we like to call him, is we've wanted to have him on the show for a while, but I've been too lazy to call you up. And now...
Yeah, I'm really hard to find, too. I have such a minimal online presence.
How
that was sarcasm.
How many Star Trek books have you written? And we're including e-novels and e-this's.
Oh,
geez. Give me the number. Like you don't have it memorized.
No, I don't, actually. I've got about 15 novels and books, and then on top of that, about 10 e-books.
All right.
E-book novellas, and then about a half dozen short stories and 6 comic books.
And your favorite? I know what your favorite is, but tell me. What's your favorite? You got to pick one.
Probably my favorite of the ones I've written would be Articles of the
Federation.
Of course,
that was what I knew you would say. Because I'll tell you why. Can I tell you why it's your favorite?
Tell me why. Tell me why that's my favorite book.
I'm gonna tell
person reading my mind.
I'm going to tell you why. Because there are a zillion great Star Trek books, but, you know, they're set on the Enterprise. They're set on Voyager. That Articles of the Federation is really the only one that's set offstage, right? It's set on Earth.
There are a few others. I mean, I'd argue The Final Reflection falls into that category, too. But
don't ruin my theory here on the podcast. No, but what I'm saying is it is for fans who are always like, hey, what's happening down on Earth while all those things are happening?
Well, that was part of the impetus for writing it. I mean, the TV shows and the movies have given us plenty of looks at the Klingon government, the Cardassian government, the Romulan government, the Bajoran government. We never really got to, and like the governments of individual planets that they would visit that week. But we never really got a good look at the Federation government. We had three times we saw a Federation president. Once we saw the Federation council, and that was it.
Yeah.
There needed to be something that explored it. I mean, we knew more about the inner workings of the Klingon High Council than we did the Federation council.
That's wrong.
And I always thought that was something that needed to be explored.
Yeah.
So I did. One of the reasons why it's one of my favorites is not just that I enjoyed writing it, although I did, but also the influence that the book has had since then. In the 12 years since the book came out, it's been the touchstone for how to write the Federation government in all the 24th century literature since then. The character of Nan Bako became a major supporting character in the Trek fiction, which is not something I ever imagined happening. I figured she'd show up in that novel and that would be it.
Yeah.
And she might get mentioned once or twice as a cameo or a gag or something. I did not expect her to become a major supporting character or, you know, unfortunately, for her death to actually be the launching point of a major series, you know.
Right.
So that was just, it blew my mind. And it was one of the coolest things. That's one of the reasons why it's my favorite. It's not just the book itself, which I still am quite proud of.
And you've also sunk your teeth deep into Klingons.
A little bit, yeah.
With the IKS Gorkon trilogy, or is it a tetralogy, actually?
Well, there were three books that were billed IKS Gorkon. I had written two previous stories that the Gorkon appeared in, and then one Next Generation novel that introduced them, and then in the Brave and the Bold crossover series. And then I did three IKS Gorkon books and one Klingon Empire book.
Right, the house...
A burning house.
A burning house.
Yes.
Now, Keith, there are some listeners... We have a wide diversity range of people. Some listeners have read every utterance of every author here.
Okay.
And some haven't really gotten into Star Trek books.
And some are sitting there wondering, who is this DeCandido dude, and why am I listening to
him? They're saying IKS Gorkon. What the heck is that? That sounds kind of cool.
It is a Klingon ship.
Give us a little intro into the IKS Gorkon.
The Gorkon is a Klingon ship. Its mission is to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, and conquer them for the greater glory of the Klingon Empire.
Oh, a little twist there.
Yeah. It's basically doing Star Trek adventures from the Klingon perspective. Yeah. It's got them really do actually seek out new life and new civilizations. They're doing an exploration. They encounter interesting alien species and deal with them in a very Klingon way. And then in the Klingon Empire book, which was A Burning House, I wanted to take a broader look at the Empire generally, using the Gorkon as the base for it. In the third book, they were in a major skirmish, and the ship got the crap kicked out of it. So they had to report back to Kronos and get the ship repaired. And while it was being repaired, the crew goes off and, you know, visits home or visits wherever they got to go. And they all have different adventures. So we got to look at a Klingon farm, a Klingon opera company, a Klingon medical conference, which is scary. And plus there's the usual, you know, political intrigue. There's a thing with Imperial intelligence. But I wanted to, and there's also, we also get to see a Klingon slum, what that looks like. Just generally, you know, looking at, because in the shows and the movies, we've only seen the military and the government. And since it's a military dictatorship, the military is the government.
Yeah.
But we don't get to see everyday life very often.
Right, right.
The nature of it, of this type of dramatic fiction is that we only see a very limited sampling of the people who live
right,
there.
Right, and that's always been a great selling point for these novels is what do our characters do on their off hours?
Yeah.
You know, and you get occasional episodes like Lower Decks and TNG Season 7, but, you know, you get to really sink your teeth into it with this sort of thing.
And that was part of the appeal of both those books, both Articles of the Federation and the Klingon books, and another book I did, which I honestly think is, looking at it objectively as I can, my own work, the best novel I've ever written, Star Trek or otherwise, which was a Lost Era novel called The Art of the Impossible.
Aha. Uh-huh.
Which
tell people what Lost Era is, if they're
the Lost Era is a series. It's an umbrella title for a series of books. We did six of them in 2003, and there've been a few more since. It's a novel that takes place between The Generation's Prelude, when Kirk got swallowed by the Nexus, and Encounter at Farpoint, when the Enterprise D launches.
It's that little
era
in between.
There's about 70 years of time in there.
Yeah.
That has been explored in bits and pieces here and there, but there's a whole raft of storytelling possibilities. Yeah. There have been novels in that time period that have involved the Enterprise B with Captain Harriman, that involved Sulu on the Excelsior, and then later stuff, one of them focused on Riker in the early days of his career. Things like that. Christopher Bennett did a novel that showed Picard's time between when he lost the Stargazer and when he took over the Enterprise. David R. George did a Harriman story. Andy Mankels and Mike Martin did an Excelsior story. What I did was there was a 30-second conversation between Bashir and Garak in The Way of the Warrior, which was the fourth season premiere of Deep Space Nine, where they mentioned the Batrika Nebula incident. What we know about the Batrika Nebula incident is as follows. One, it involved the Klingons and the Cardassians. Two, it was, according to Garak, ages ago.
Right.
And three, peculiarly for an incident, it lasted 18 years.
That's a long incident.
Using only these three facts as the basis, I built an entire 100,000-word novel that took place during this 70-year period. It starts in 2328, which is roughly I'm trying to remember why I picked that date in particular. It was over a decade ago, but basically that was roughly when Cardassia first made contact with Bajor.
Right. Okay. Okay. Good. Yeah.
It ended in 2346, which was the year of the Kittimer massacre, that claimed Worf's parents.
Right.
And
or so we thought.
And also when Station Tarak Nor was built, that was exactly 18 years, and I figured that was a good span to do. And it's this cold war that erupts between the Cardassians and the Klingons. It never actually breaks out into a full blown war, but there's a great deal of tension and conflict over the claim over one particular planet that's halfway between both of them, near the Batrika Nebula, hence the name of the incident. And what was fun about it was dealing with all the different aspects of how this affected normal people. How it affected the military, how it affected my two favorite chapters I wrote in it were when tensions are particularly nasty between the Klingons and the Cardassians. There is a Klingon who has opened a Klingon restaurant on Cardassia Prime.
That's sort of your stock is the culture and how it affects the day-to-day.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah.
This is a guy who, if he tried to open a Klingon restaurant in Klingon space, he would have been eaten alive because there was, you know, there's not enough, you know, there's plenty of Klingon restaurants.
Right.
Cardassia, he's unique. It's exotic.
And it would be the type of thing that certain dissident people would like, let's go get Klingon food on Cardassia.
Exactly.
You know?
And so he winds up being attacked by the Cardassian military because Klingons are no longer welcome on Cardassia. And then the next chapter is a Cardassian who is retired, and what he is doing in his retirement is going to different worlds, and he's a climber. He likes to climb mountains. So he's going to different worlds and finding cool mountains to climb, and he's climbing one in Klingon space. He gets back down from the mountain and gets basically attacked. Because Klingons are pissed at Cardassians also. And he doesn't even know anything about the Klingons. He's an old retired guy. He just wants to climb his mountains, and all of a sudden he's attacked. So that's the kind of thing I like to do generally, is how big events affect everyday people.
Yeah, yeah. What was the name of that one again?
That was called The Art of the Impossible.
The Art of the Impossible, okay.
What's interesting about the book to me is that there isn't a single protagonist, really. It's about the... There's several characters who play major roles in it, including Curzon Dax has a very large role in it.
Oh, Curzon Dax, okay. Yeah.
The Worf's family plays a role in it. His grandfather, who we saw defending Kirk and McCoy in Star Trek VI,
sure.
You see him as an older man,
yeah.
As a general. General Worf. And then we also see his mother and father, Moog, and I actually didn't name his mother because she didn't have one.
Mrs. Moog. Mom Moog.
And I actually dramatized the Kittimer Massacre, too.
Oh, man.
That was part of what I did with that, was actually show that happening, including Worf's rescue,
sure.
and why the Rozhenkos took him in and so on.
You know, he's Moses, by the way.
Really?
Think about it. He's left in a basket.
Wasn't a basket.
He's left in a basket on Kittimer, and his parents take him. To me, Worf is Moses.
Okay. Whatever works for you.
Ian has a question.
Ian has a question. Right. What's your question, Ian?
How psyched is your inner teenage Star Trek fan at all these work you've gotten to do over the years?
Oh, it's been great. I started reading Star Trek novels when I was very young. I started reading them when I was around when the motion picture came out. Because I think the first Star Trek novel I actually read, actually no, that's not true. Before that, I read the James Blish book, so that was my entree into Trek prose. And then I read Spock Must Die, and then I read Roddenberry's novelization. I didn't actually track down the Bantam books until later, but aside from Spock Must Die, I hadn't read any of the others.
They have, by the way, an initial pressing of Spock Must Die over there.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Once I hit my teen years, I was consuming Star Trek fiction at a great rate, both in prose and comics form. And I, from that moment, I always wanted to be one of the guys who did that.
Yeah.
And I got to be for quite a while. So that was cool. That's something I've really enjoyed.
What else do you? Is there anything that you geek out on as much, or even what comes second place to Star Trek? Is it DC Comics, Marvel? Is it Star Wars? Is it
in
Lord
terms
of the Rings?
Getting to work
is it,
on stuff?
No, I mean your personal
just
love.
In general?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if I could narrow it down. There's a lot of different things. I mean, let's put it this way. If there was some way, I'm sitting here in a perfect recreation of the Starship Enterprise from the original series. The only thing I could think of that would make me geek out as much would be if somebody had recreated the 4077th from MASH.
Did not see that coming.
Because that was that
but no,
was
but that's cool. Yeah, I mean, sure, and there are similarities.
Yeah.
There are certainly similarities. I mean, I think a Hawkeye and Bones would get along really well, don't you? And Major
Probably.
Burns would. Who would befriend Major Burns?
Nobody. No. Major Burns.
Shelby, Admiral Shelby and Major Burns. Maybe.
I mean, Frank Burns was summed up in a conversation between him and Trapper when Frank asked Trapper, "Why does everybody take an instant dislike to me?" And Trapper says, "It saves time, Frank."
What's next? What are you working on?
Oh, lots of things. In terms, as we record this, my next book to be released will be a novel called Marvel's Warriors 3, which is Godhood's End, which is the third book in my Tales of Asgard trilogy. There was a Thor book that came out in 2015, a Sif book which came out in 2016.
Oh, I love Sif.
Yes.
Now, are these books springing from the MCU, or are they springing from...
No, they're springing from the comics, although if you're only familiar with the MCU, you'll be fine.
Okay,
they
great.
Take place entirely in Asgard.
Awesome.
It's they're references to the other heroes, but basically it's all taking place in Asgard, so it's something, if you're only familiar with Chris Hemsworth and Tom Hiddleston and not Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and Walt Simonson, you'll be fine.
Awesome.
I've also got coming later this year an Orphan Black book.
Oh, wow.
Called Classified Clone Report, which is a reference book that collates a bunch of different little bits of information from the series. It's presented as files assembled by Delphine Cormier, one of the characters in the show, of emails and reports and stuff that she's collected about the various happenings on the show.
Yeah.
And that's going to come out concurrently with the release of the fifth season, which will be the final season this summer on BBC America.
Awesome.
I've got stories in a bunch of anthologies, one that just got released called Aliens Bug Hunt, edited by Jonathan Mayberry. That ties into
the aliens world.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. They're all stories specifically about the Colonial Marines.
Awesome.
And Knights of the Living Dead, which is co-edited by George Romero himself, which is all stories that take place around the events of the 1968 movie. I've got a short story in an anthology called Baker Street Irregulars, which is alternate Sherlock Holmes stories.
Like with, a multiverse, a myriad universe?
Yeah, of Sherlock Holmes stories. Mine take place in modern New York. I've got a story coming out this month in TV Gods Summer Programming, which is about gods on television. And I'm sure I'm forgetting. Oh, and then this fall I'm going to have the latest in my fantasy police procedural series, Mermaid Precinct.
That sounds awesome.
And, and a bunch of other stuff.
Wait, what's Mermaid Precinct? Are these mermaid cops?
The first book was called Dragon Precinct, followed by Unicorn Precinct, Goblin Precinct, Griffin Precinct, and now Mermaid Precinct. It's a fantasy setting with humans and elves and dwarves and wizards and magic and stuff, but the main characters are detectives who solve crimes, and the city-state is divided into 5 precincts.
Okay.
Mermaid Precinct is the docks. It's a port town.
Dragon
Precinct is the middle-class district. Unicorn Precinct is the upper-class district. Goblin Precinct is the slum. And then Griffin Precinct is the castle that's the center of the city
state. You've written
so.
A lot of stories based on existing material.
Yes.
If somebody went and made a movie or a TV show based on one of your original pieces.
I would love that because they tend to like give you money for that.
And why?
Oh, God. Any of them.
The check clears. I don't care.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. I mean, probably the one... I don't know. I like all of them.
Well, what's the most visual? What's the most story-driven that could tell an extended
I mean,
story?
I think honestly, the one that might be the coolest to do in live-action form, only because of where it takes place, I have a series, TV Gods is one of them, series of short stories that take place in Key West, Florida, involving a woman named Cassie Zukov, who's a bit of a weirdness magnet. And it takes place in Key West, and it involves scuba diving, rock and roll music, Norse gods, folklore, and beer drinking. Not necessarily in that order. Most of the action takes place either in a bar in Old Town in Key West. Several Norse gods are recurring characters, as is the ghost of an old wrecker captain, an immortal barfly who can't actually drink alcohol. Because if he falls asleep, he'll die. And an FBI agent who babbles a lot. And a house band that includes one of the Norse gods, Loki's ex-wife, as the drummer. And I think that would be fun just because it takes place in Key West, so I would have to film in Key West.
Right, and you would get to go down and visit. Well, listen, Keith, thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
I know you want to get back to your section there and sign some autographs, but this is a blast. I've always wanted to have you on the show, and we'll do it again.
Well, what took you so long?
I apologize. Okay, so I'm in the booth here. We set up a little booth at the Star Trek original series set tour, and we've got Dave Glantner. Did I pronounce it correctly?
Glanter.
Glanter, I'm sorry.
Or Gallanter, either way.
Gallanter sounds
half
nice.
Half the family does one way, half the other.
And you are a Star Trek novelist, and you have written, give me the exact total of Star Trek books you've written.
I don't even know. I think there's been 6 or 7 different Star Trek novels, 3 of them original series, 3 of them Next Generation, a Voyager book, and various short stories and anthologies and things like that.
So walking this tour today was like walking through your own imagination a little bit.
Well, you know what? I've actually been to the sets when they were filming Star Trek New Voyages, and this is the first time I've seen everything put together. But I will tell you this. It has helped write books, because to be on these sets and then to choreograph and stage things in your books, you have a much better mindset of where things were that you didn't see on the TV show, you didn't see the depth and how close together things are.
Yeah.
And it feels much more like a ship.
Being in the medical bay... The two different rooms, like it finally clicked. Oh, that's what the sick bay is like.
It's right.
There's McCoy's front room, and then the back is where the bio beds are, and Nurse Chapel walking through. It finally clicked for me. And this, you know, and these guys have taken the original designs, the original blueprints. I mean, they made it as real as possible.
And it's not
exciting.
Just the it's not just the sights, but it's the sounds.
Yes,
you hear the engines of the ship. You hear, the little sonar ping on the bridge. And it's a beautiful experience in that sense. And you can push the button. And
well, you weren't supposed to do that.
Well, James pushed the button.
Okay.
And the red alert lights flashed.
Yeah,
you heard the klaxon screaming. And if that doesn't put you on the ship, And it, even though it's not, it's a set.
Yeah.
But if that doesn't put you there, nothing else will.
So tell me a little bit about writing, TO, since we're in a TOS mindset today, writing the TOS characters. We were talking a little bit about, before about... you got to really sink your teeth into Bones McCoy and got to do something you never thought would be approved by the powers that be that you got to slip in.
I did. I got a chance to have him challenge Kirk and say about somebody living or dying, who's going to decide, McCoy asks. James T. Christ. and I didn't think they'd let that in, but they did. It's
well,
one
it's
of my favorite lines.
In character for Bones during a moment of strife.
And when I write a classic Trek novel, a TOS novel, I like to do it like you're watching an extended episode of the show. Mm. So every chapter end is a commercial break. As best as I can make it, and that you feel the characters are hopefully saying the things that they would say on
the
show.
Do you hear the music in your head?
I do.
Awesome.
I hear the music.
Yeah.
I hear the actors. You can't get out of Nimoy's head and voice when you're doing his character. And that's my goal, and the highest compliment anybody ever pays me is that it sounds like they sound like the characters they've seen on TV.
Awesome. Well, Dave, I want to let you go back to your table. Before I do, if there's someone listening right now who has not, for whatever reason, has not yet sunk their teeth into one of your books, because there is a vast catalog of Star Trek books out there, and if you were to say you want to read one of my things, the number one you should go to is
I would say Troublesome Minds,
okay,
which is a very Spock-centric novel, or Crisis of Consciousness, which is another Spock-centric novel.
Okay,
so and if those you love are, Spock, pick up one of those books.
So, what was the first one again?
Troublesome Minds.
Troublesome Minds and
Crisis of Consciousness.
And they are both available wherever you find
Amazon, Barnes & Noble,
yeah,
all over.
And you can also download to the Kindle, to
yes,
the Nook,
indeed,
to the Schnook, to all those things.
iBooks, all of them.
Awesome. Well, listen, thanks again. And we've got some fans are now trickling in that probably want to buy some of your stuff. And
I
maybe
hope so.
Maybe get your John Hancock also.
All right. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
All right, test. Wait, check. Hello, are we recording? Yes.
Sound level, is that okay? Is that
Kevin,
you?
You know, we've never recorded you on this show.
I think that's correct.
Dayton's been on.
Yes.
But you haven't.
Well, you know, I'm more of a phantom, I guess. you can't look at me in direct light.
Kevin Dillmore is the author of roughly 900,000 Star Trek novels. Many of them are written in collaboration with Dayton Ward. Not all of them.
No, well, I have had several short stories in the Star Trek universe on my own, but if it's a novel, I wrote it with Dayton. I've not written a full novel myself.
Well,
why is that?
Yeah, why is that? Man?
I'm inept.
You have a bug on you.
I do?
Right by your Delta shield, there's a bug crawling on you.
Thanks.
Tell the people at home who are listening about... go ahead.
To legitimately answer the question. Yeah. I have always worked as a full-time writer outside of my Star Trek writing. I began as a newspaper reporter. I currently am a senior writer at Hallmark Cards, and I've never really been able to hit the deadline on a full novel on my own.
Mm.
So Dayton graciously makes time in his schedule that, here are projects we could work on together. And then when he is working on something solo, then, I work on my regular stuff.
But gotcha.
But when his schedule allows for us to collaborate, then that's what we do.
Well, so far the formula's been working out. So
we've had a lot of fun. We've been doing it together for 17 years now.
Wow. Tell us a little bit about the people at home can't see it, but the shirt you're wearing. This is not a typical Star Trek shirt.
This is my Anovos shirt. I believe they call it a Star Trek retro uniform shirt. It's Command Green, which is probably not a color you readily identify.
It's never been on television.
Iconic. No, but yeah. It was something that was a licensed color. It's really more evocative of the weird colors that they had for uniforms in the original Gold Key comics, which is why I got it.
You are a walking cannon breach is what you are today.
Yes, that's exactly my whole goal is to take it reverently, but not too serious.
Yeah, well, you guys love this Gold Key comics, right?
Absolutely.
You did a hats off to Gold Key recently,
we
right?
We did, in Star Trek Waypoint, which is a limited series by IDW Publishing. In issue number 2, we wrote a story. I believe we called it, the Menace of the Mechanicatrons. And the whole idea of it was to bring in elements that Gold Key would bring into their stories that would work great in comics because you have no more budget than ink and paper.
Right.
So you can have Kirk and Spock at the controls of these weird robots fighting Klingons on an alien planet and you know, it costs the same. So we like doing that goofy stuff.
Yeah, no, it was a good one.
What is the process between the two of you? Especially, how has it changed since internet didn't really exist back when you started?
The advantage that we enjoyed is that we live roughly in the same town. Dayton and I, throughout our career, have lived no more than 40 miles apart. So we would trade chapters back and forth on the internet, but a lot of time for our brainstorming or even just, you know, our creative just running around. I mean, a day for us that we're together typically might be, you know, go get some lunch, hit a couple of used bookstores, a couple of comic stores. While we're driving, we're riffing on stories. We attended a convention in Denver a couple of weeks ago, and on our drive to Denver and drive back, which is about 9 hours each way, we brainstormed all sorts of stuff. So we really just kind of throw ideas around, see what amuses us, or see what we think we could have fun taking. And it's really kind of, we need to settle on a story we can divide well. You know, like in Legacies, book 3, Purgatory's Key, was the last novel we worked on together.
Which ruled, by the way.
Well, you're very kind. Thank you. He did a lot of the, more Federation, the tradition Federation mission, you know, the objective of getting into the alien stronghold and disabling or destroying it, whereas I took the first drafts on chapters that were much more metaphysical, you know, with Sarek and Number One and Joanna McCoy in this
floating in the nether basically. Void of. They were in the, if I may.
Sure.
Let me see if I got it. Because
I'll get it.
Were in an alternate dimension.
Yes.
They were in the zone that the Tantalus device zaps you to.
That
and it's
was
not
what
the
we were...
not the mirror universe, just some additional universe.
Correct.
And what you later discovered is that it was sort of like almost like a hollow projection of your thoughts.
More or less, yes. You were able to manipulate it was a realm that allowed anybody who was in it to kind of craft their own reality.
Right, but they didn't know.
But they didn't know it.
Yeah, until they were.
Yeah. I was able to write Sarek as Doctor Strange. That was my goal.
Oh, cool. Yeah, now that you mentioned that, it really did click in. Perfect, yeah.
Yes.
It's a great Sarek story.
So thank you.
And McCoy's daughter is great. I mean, she's a chip off the old block.
I am a huge fan of Dr. McCoy. I've always had partiality to Starfleet Medical. If you look at a lot of the stuff that Dayton and I have done together, more than likely, if there's a thread of some sort of a medical threat or medical need, I'll end up interjecting myself into that. But
yeah.
I definitely grabbed Joanna to write in from her perspective, not only because I wanted her to kind of be a chip off the old block, but my daughter is roughly the same age as Joanna. She was just finishing a run of school in Starfleet Academy, and my daughter's just graduating college right now.
Yeah.
So I just kind of drew a little bit of her in as well.
Hopefully she won't be kidnapped by... What were they... There was...
Oh, there's all sorts
there
of...
There was... They put her through all kinds of rigmarole.
Yeah, she was... you know, yeah, she became a hostage, right. And there's all sorts of stuff that happened. That was more in Dave's book that she became a hostage.
Oh, I see. Okay,
but
good.
Then when the Tantalus device was turned against her...
Yeah.
And she was zapped into the weird realm. That's when I get a chance realm. To write her.
That's when you got it, in the realm. Yeah. Cool. Well, listen, you know, it's fun because you've got here, you know, 12 of your comrades that you probably don't get a chance to see that
no,
often.
No, this is that.
We didn't join you at lunch. How was lunch? Was that just a raucous?
It was wonderful. You know, it wasn't that. We divided and conquered. You know, I'm from Kansas City and flew all the way to upstate New York, and so what do I do is go to a barbecue joint. But, you know, again, we go for the company, not the cuisine.
Right.
And the, but oh, they did a fine job. I should say. Their smoked brisket and pulled pork was fantastic.
This just in, if you come to the Star Trek tour, you will have a good... I saw the barbecue place. It is within walking distance of here.
Yeah.
It's about 1.5 minutes on foot. You'll have a good lunch.
Yes. So. Go to Kansas City and get the proper sauce and then come here. And, they had four different sauces, and the closest that they had that came to Kansas City barbecue was ketchup.
Oh,
it's okay though. It's okay.
Ian's got a question here.
The question I'm asking everybody: what does your inner geek think of the fact that you've been able to do all of this? You must be as a kid who grew up watching this stuff. What does it mean to you?
Yeah, I never really answer this question well. I look at this as a tapestry of storytelling over the last 50 years, and I've been invited to sew in a block of this quilt, in a sense. And that's always fun, to have somebody and recognize that somewhere a story that I collaborated on or maybe even originated myself, somewhere is somebody's, you know, top five moments of Star Trek. And, you know, probably my mom. But the idea of being able to contribute to that, to kind of, you know, maybe somebody had an idea in the Star Trek universe, told a story that resonated with me, that made me want to tell a story that could inspire another storyteller to paint a picture of Star Trek, give me a facet of a character, a nuance in the universe that I had never considered, that makes me want to think about Star Trek or renews my enjoyment of it in a whole new way. That's the fun part of being that kid who now is able to do this kind of thing.
And then Star Trek-wise, what's next?
For me, you know what's next? I can't talk about it.
Uh-oh.
I know. No, I can't. I can talk. Here.
Saying that we'll discover new from you?
No.
Is that what you're talking? No? All right. Okay.
I will tell you that I'm not connected in that in any way other than through Hallmark. However, if I can jump universes for a moment, I worked on, for the last year and a half, a 7-ornament 3-year series for Keepsake Ornaments that is connected to the first Star Wars film.
Oh.
And we were at Star Wars Celebration in April, walking out, showing it to everyone, unveiling it for the first time. Veronica Hart from CBS was walking out with me. She's Senior Vice President of Consumer Products, and she was walking out having seen this unveiling in front of a crowd of Star Wars fans. The first thing she said to me was, "When are we going to do this for Star Trek?"
Wow.
I can't answer that, but I can tell you I'm already working.
Hey, look at that. A scoop breaking here on Engage, the official Star Trek podcast.
Friends here, right?
You know, it's funny. We mentioned the D word, discovery. I just realized right over there, David Mack, if we all pinned him down and shot him with some truth serum, because he is writing the prequel novel.
That's true, but the thing is with
Mac... He won't say a thing.
Well, no, you don't need to shoot him with truth serum. He shoots himself with bourbon on an hourly basis. We just need to wait for him to get just liquored up enough.
That's right.
He won't
say a thing.
I will tell you this. Dave and I have worked together for a long time. There's been a lot of people within the Star Trek universe. We absolutely respect the non-disclosure agreements that we sign on the facets of this that we work on.
I know. The microphones are still on, so you're going to say that. We appreciate that. Kevin Dillmore, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. We love you here on Engage, and we love you on the internet. You're a great gentleman, and everybody loves you.
Bless you.
And your beautiful green shirt.
Oh, I love my green shirt. So Ian's jealous of my green shirt. He said he's going to talk about it all the way home.
It's true. I may steal it from him.
And then you'll see. You'll wonder Well, we know we have Command Gold,
right.
And Engineering and Support Services Red,
right.
And Science is blue. But what is Pasty White? That's all I'll have.
In prison orange is what I'll have.
Yes.
All right. No,
this has been a delight. Invite me back.
All right.
To talk again.
We'll see you soon.
Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.